Chapter 5. The Resensitization of America. Throughout this book, we have observed the relevant factors in military training. Men are recruited at a psychologically malleable age. They are distanced from their enemy psychologically, taught to hate and dehumanize. They are given the threat of authority, the absolution and pressure of groups. Even then, they are resistant and have trouble killing. They shoot in the air. They find nonviolent tasks to occupy them. And so they still need to be conditioned. The conditioning is astoundingly effective. But there is a psychological price to pay. In this last section, we have applied what we have learned about killing on the battlefield in order to gain an understanding of killing in our society. Violent movies have been targeted at the young, both men and women, the same audience the military has determined to be most susceptible for its killing purposes. Violent video games hardwire young people for shooting at humans. The entertainment industry conditions the young in exactly the same way the military does. Civilian society apes the training and conditioning techniques of the military at its peril. Add to this the disillusion of the family. Children from all economic strata no longer have a censor, counsel, or role model at home. They turn to their peers as authority figures. In some cases, they find a family in gangs. And then there are factors that provide psychological distance in our society. American society is increasingly divided along lines of race, gender, and sex. It has become compartmentalized. People in ghettos rarely leave their own areas. The larger world, the larger community, is a foreign land. The reverse is true with middle and upper classes. They travel everywhere except for impoverished areas, which they avoid anxiously. It is quite easy to maintain this distance. They ride in their cars, they live in the suburbs, and eat in nice restaurants. The separation is not as strident as the soldier, who learns to think of his enemy as an animal or refer to him as a gook, but there is distance. The only connecting point in our society is the media. The media, which should act to bring us together, serves to pull us apart, conditioning and teaching violence, nurturing our darkest instincts, and feeding the nation with violent stereotypes that foster our deepest fears. We are most assuredly on the road to ruin, and we need desperately to find the road home from this dark and fearful place to which we have traveled. The Road to Ruin. Quote, "And in that state of nature, no arts, no letters, no society. And which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death. And the life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short." Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan. Some would claim that the modern ultraviolent movies and their video game equivalents examined here serve as a form of sublimation that will make violence and war obsolete. Sublimation is a term coined by Sigmund Freud, referring to the turning of unacceptable urges and desires towards something socially desirable, taking the dark, unacceptable drives of the id and diverting them toward the sublime. Thus, someone with a desire to slice open bodies may become a surgeon, or someone with an unacceptable urge towards violence may channel it towards sports, the military, or law enforcement. But watching movies is not sublimation. The entertainment industry is not providing a socially acceptable channeling of energy. Indeed, very little energy is generally spent in the passive reception of television and movies. And this hardly qualifies as a socially acceptable or desirable channel for energies. Unless it has become socially desirable to kill outside the authority of the law, or to murder innocent victims, which, in the twisted world of the entertainment industry, it has. If violence in television and movies were a form of sublimation, and if it were at all effective, then per capita violence should be going down. Instead, it has multiplied nearly 5 times in the span of the same generation in which this supposed sublimation has become available. It is not sublimation or even neutral entertainment. It is classical conditioning, operant conditioning, and social learning, all focused toward the violence enabling of an entire society. When our hockey players and other sports figures display a degree of lawlessness, violence, and aggression never before seen in such competitions, we should begin to wonder. when the mother of one high school cheerleader is convicted of hiring a hitman to murder her daughter's competitor for the cheerleading squad, and when the bodyguard of one Olympic figure skater attempts to eliminate the competition by maiming an opponent, we should begin to understand that this is a society that is increasingly conditioned to turn to violence as the answer to all of its difficulties. When a kindergartner in Flint, Michigan commits a murder in his school, when two middle schoolers in Jonesboro, Arkansas gun down two teachers and 13 little girls, when two high school students in Littleton, Colorado commit the all-time record juvenile mass murder, and when a college student in Virginia Tech commits the all-time record school shooting, we have begun to realize that we have desensitized an entire generation of children, and we are indeed teaching our kids to kill. And the road home, the resensitization of America. Quote, male power, male dominance, masculinity, male sexuality, male aggression are not biologically determined. They are conditioned. What is conditioned can be deconditioned. Man can change. Catherine Netzen, Pornography, Women, Violence, and Civil Liberties. So what is the answer? Which is the road home from this dark and fearful place to which we have traveled? Perhaps it is time to begin the resensitization of America. When the framers of the U.S. Constitution wrote the Second Amendment, guaranteeing the right to keep and bear arms, they never dreamed that the concept of arms could someday include weapons of mass destruction that can vaporize whole cities. In the same way, until late in the 20th century, no one ever dreamed that the right to free speech could include mechanisms of mass conditioning and desensitization. During the 1930s, our society began for the first time to consider the need to control access to high explosives. And today, even the most ardent defender of Second Amendment rights would not argue for private ownership of trucks full of high explosives, artillery, nerve gas, or nuclear arms. In the same way, perhaps the time has come for society to consider the price being paid for the implications of technology on some First Amendment rights. There is no more need to constrain the print media than there is to control Bowie knives, tomahawks, or flintlock muskets. But there might just be a justification for controlling the technology that goes beyond print media and flintlocks. The more advanced the technology, the greater the need for control. In the realm of weapons technologies, that means controlling explosives, artillery, and machine guns. And above all else, that means controlling children's access to firearms. In the realm of media technology, that may mean that the time has come to consider controlling children's access to violent visual imagery in television, movies, and video games. Technology has leapfrogged in a variety of ways that change the context of violence in our society. Today, technology has enabled distribution of a much wider variety of entertainment, movies, television, videos, video games, multimedia, and interactive television, specialized magazines, and the internet. The result is that entertainment is now a private act. In many cases, this is good, but in many cases, it has had the potential for developing, feeding, and sustaining individual pathologies. We have a 200-year-old tradition of protecting the right to free speech and the right to bear arms. Obviously, though, our founding fathers did not have these factors, let alone operant conditioning, in mind when they wrote the Constitution. Media critic Michael Medved believes that some form of censorship, either self-censorship or the formal legal kind, is in the cards, and that this might not be so bad, pointing out that the age of censorship in Hollywood was also the age of greatest artistry, yielding such movies as Gone with the Wind and Casablanca. As Simon Jenkins put it in a London Times editorial, censorship is external regulation and therefore professional anathema. Yet such sanction is the community's natural response to what it feels might threaten its stability, be it adulterated food, dangerous drugs, guns, or films that incite social evils. Filmmakers, like all artists, claim a license from such sanction. They are observers outside of society looking in. But the license is held on lease. It is not freehold. It can be withdrawn. But the road to resensitization is probably not through formal censorship. certainly not through censorship of adults. But just as we regulate children's access to guns, drugs, pornography, alcohol, sex, automobiles, fireworks, and tobacco, so too must we begin to address the sale of violent visual media to children. What we must realize is that our society is trapped in a pathological spiral, with all vectors pulling inward toward a tighter and tighter cycle of violence and destruction. The prescription for resensitization is as complex and interactive as has been the path to our current dark state. Guns, drugs, poverty, gangs, war, racism, sexism, and the destruction of the nuclear family are just a few of the factors that can act to cheapen human life. The current debates over euthanasia, abortion, and the death penalty indicate that we are divided over the ethics of life and death. To greater or lesser degrees, each of these factors helps to pull us toward destruction, and any comprehensive war on crime needs to consider all of them. But these factors have always been there. The new factor that is at work today is the same factor that increased the firing rate from 15% to 20% in World War II, the 90% to 95% in Vietnam. The new factor is desensitization and killing enabling in the media. Television programmers have always tried to claim the best of two uncomfortably contradictory worlds, as Michael Medved puts it. It is really not new or profound to point out that television executives have for years claimed that they are not capable of influencing our actions or changing behavior. But for decades, America's major corporations have paid them billions of dollars for a paltry few seconds or a minute to do just that. To sponsors, media executives claim that just a few well-placed seconds can control how America will spend its hard-earned money. But to Congress and other watchdog agencies, they argue that they are not responsible for causing viewers to change the way they will respond to any emotionally charged, potentially violent circumstance that they may subsequently find themselves in. This in spite of the fact that as of 1994, there have been more than 200 studies demonstrating the correlation between television and violence. The body of scientific evidence against the media is overwhelming. In March 1994, Professor Elizabeth Newson, head of the Child Development Unit at Nottingham University in England, released a report signed by 25 psychologists and pediatricians. They wrote, "Many of us hold our liberal ideals of freedom of expression dear, but now begin to feel that we were naive in our failure to predict the extent of damaging material and its all-too-free availability to children. By restricting such material from home viewing, society must take on a necessary responsibility in protecting children from this, as from other forms of child abuse." By calling for legislation to limit the availability of video nasties, Professor Newson and her colleagues raised a storm of controversy in Britain. They also became the latest in a series of scientists to publicly join the ever-swelling ranks of those who are convinced by the scientific research linking violence in the media to violent crime. In the spring 1993 issue of The Public Interest, Dr. Brandon Centerwall, professor of epidemiology at the University of Washington, summarized the overwhelming nature of this body of evidence. His report focused on the effect of television when it was introduced to rural, isolated communities in Canada and when English-language TV broadcasts were permitted in South Africa in 1975, having previously been banned by the Afrikaans-speaking government. In each case, violent crime among children increased spectacularly. Centerwall points out that aggressive impulses, like most human phenomena, are distributed along a bell-shaped curve, and the significant effect of any change will occur at the margins. He notes, "It is an intrinsic effect of such bell curve distribution that small changes in the average imply major changes at the extremes. Thus, if an exposure to television causes 8% of the population to shift from below average aggression to above average aggression, it follows that the homicide rate will double. In statistical terms, an increase in the aggressive predisposition of 8% of the population is very small. Anything less than 5% is not even considered to be statistically significant. But in human terms, The impact of doubling the homicide rate is enormous. Centerwall concludes, the evidence indicates that if, hypothetically, television technology had never been developed, there would today be 10,000 fewer homicides each year in the United States, 70,000 fewer rapes, and 700,000 fewer injurious assaults. Violent crime would be half what it is. The evidence is quite simply overwhelming. The American Psychological Association's Commission on Violence and Youth concluded in 1993 that there is absolutely no doubt that higher levels of viewing violence on television are correlated with increased acceptance of aggressive attitudes and increased aggressive behavior. The medical and mental health communities have no agenda, no cause to twist the data. In general, the medical and mental health community's only goal is public health. And if individual members turn from that goal, they are accountable to their state certification boards, the television, movie, and video game industries, and their handful of non-medical defenders can say anything they want, and generally do anything short of a provable, prosecutable criminal act, and there is no accountability. It is important to make this last point, because any time the media violence industry turns this into a dueling experts debate, they win. It is not a case of dueling experts. It is a case of this industry versus the entire medical and mental health community. Ultimately, in the face of all this evidence, the deglamorization and condemnation of violence in the media is inevitable. It will be done in simple self-defense as our society rises up against the enabling of the violent crimes that are destroying our lives, our cities, and our civilization. When it occurs, this process will probably be similar to the deglamorization of drugs and tobacco that has occurred in recent years and for much the same reasons. Throughout history, nations, corporations, and individuals have used noble-sounding concepts such as states' rights, Lebensraum, free market economies, and constitutional rights to mask their actions. But ultimately, what they are doing is for their own personal gain, and the result, intentional or not, is killing innocent men, women, and children. They participate in a diffusion of responsibility by referring to themselves as the tobacco industry or the entertainment industry, and we permit it. But they are ultimately individuals making individual moral decisions to participate in the destruction of their fellow citizens. The ever-ascending tide of violence in our society must be stopped. Each act of violence breeds ever greater levels of violence. The study of killing in combat teaches us that soldiers who have had friends or relatives killed or injured in combat are much more likely to kill and commit war crimes. Each individual who is injured or killed by criminal violence becomes a focal point for further violence on the part of their friends and family. Every destructive act gnaws away at the restraint of other men. Each act of violence eats away at the fabric of our society like a cancer, spreading and reproducing itself in ever-expanding cycles of horror and destruction. The genie of violence cannot really ever be stuffed back into the bottle. It can only be cut off here and now, and then the slow process of healing and resensitization can begin. It can be done. It has been done in the past. As Richard Heckler observes, there is a precedent for limiting violence-enabling technology. It started with the classical Greeks, who for four centuries refused to implement the bow and arrow, even after being introduced to it in a most unpleasant way by Persian archers. In Giving Up the Gun, Noel Perrin tells how the Japanese banned firearms after their introduction by the Portuguese in the 1500s. The Japanese quickly recognized that the military use of gunpowder threatened the very fabric of their society and culture, and they moved aggressively to defend their way of life. The feuding Japanese warlords destroyed all existing weapons and made the production or import of any new guns punishable by death. Three centuries later, when Commodore Perry forced the Japanese to open their ports, they did not even have the technology to make firearms. Similarly, the Chinese invented gunpowder but elected not to use it in warfare. But the most encouraging examples of restraining killing technology have all occurred in the 20th century. After the tragic experience of using poisonous gases in World War I, The world has generally rejected their use ever since. The Atmospheric Nuclear Test Ban Treaty and the ban on the deployment of anti-satellite weapons are both still going strong across many turbulent decades, and the United States and the former USSR have been steadily reducing their stockpiles of nuclear weapons since the end of the Cold War. As we have de-escalated instruments of mass destruction, so too can we de-escalate instruments of mass desensitization. Heckler points out that there has been an almost unnoticed series of precedents for reducing military technology on moral grounds. Precedents that show the way for understanding that we do have a choice about how we think about war, about killing, and about the value of human life in our society. In recent years, we have exercised the choice to move ourselves from the brink of nuclear destruction. In the same way, our society can move away from the technology that enables killing. Education and understanding are the first step. The end result may be that we will come through these dark years as a healthier, more self-aware society. To fail to do this leaves us with only two possible results: to go the route of the Mongols and the Third Reich, or the route of Lebanon and Yugoslavia. No other result is possible if successive generations continue to grow up with greater and greater desensitization to the suffering of their fellow human beings. We must put the safety catch back on our society. We have to understand, as we have never understood before, why it is that men fight and kill and, equally important, why it is that they will not. Only on the basis of understanding human behavior can we hope to influence it. The essence of this audiobook has been that there is a force within mankind that will cause men to rebel against killing, even at the risk of their own lives. That force has existed in man throughout recorded history. And military history can be interpreted as a record of society's attempts to force its members to overcome their resistance in order to kill more effectively in battle. But that force for life, Freud's Eros, is balanced by the Thanatos, the death force. And we have seen how pervasive and consistent has been the battle between these two forces throughout history. We have learned how to enable the Thanatos. We know how to take the psychological safety catch off of human beings almost as easily as you would switch a weapon from safe to fire. We must understand where and what that psychological safety catch is, how it works, and how to put it back on. That is the purpose of Killology, and that has been the goal of this audiobook.
This has been an Hachette Audio production of On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society, written and read by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, produced and directed by John Clem, recorded by Keith Vivrette at Studio V, audio edited by Gabino Reyes. On Killing is also available in print from Back Bay Books, an imprint of Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 1995, 1996, and 2009 by David A. Grossman. Audio production copyright and published 2009 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.